As a general rule, I tend to be, I like to be more supportive than not. I have this philosophy, and this could get us in all kinds of trouble, but my view is that do the thing that your 80-year-old self would be proud you did. Right.
Smart.
So my view is, if you genuinely have a business idea that you think has legs and you want to give it a go, then go for it. You know, because I think at the end of the day, you know, the worst thing that can happen is it doesn't work. And that's a better outcome to have and to know, rather than the what if, or if only I did, you know. So I would rather have lived and failed than not have tried at all.
Hello and welcome to So You Want to Start a Business, the podcast where we interview business owners, entrepreneurs and other smart guests so we can learn their tips, tactics and strategies. I'm your host, Ingrid Thompson, and it's my absolute pleasure to bring you these interviews. Every guest has a unique perspective on business, and today is no exception. That is the voice of Kimberly Chan. Kimberly was a corporate lawyer and now she teaches meditation. Her story is terrific. So let's settle in for our discussion about her business startup journey. Kimberly is delightful and there are some remarkable insights during this interview conversation. Are you ready? Let's go. Hello, and today we are talking to Kimberly Chan. And Kimberly has a terrific startup story for us. Good afternoon, Kim.
Hi. Hi, Ingrid. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you as well. So Kim, let's get started. What is your business? What business are you in?
So I run a business called Kimberly Chan Meditation. So I teach a meditation technique called Vedic meditation, which is a very ancient technique that comes from India but is really universal in nature. And it uses a mantra to help guide us through the more active thought-filled states of our minds towards the deeper, quieter, subtler states. And in the process, basically helping us to release all our daily stresses that we accumulate, and also the long held stresses that we may be carrying that we're not aware of. And so I teach people to meditate, and in the process, helping them to release stress and usually creating space for them to do the things that they really want to do and to live the fullest expression of their lives.
Oh my gosh, and you just have the most amazing voice, Kimberly. I already feel more relaxed. Oh.
Do you know, it's hilarious. The lady who interviewed me about a month ago said the same thing. and I haven't listened to my voice because I'm a bit kind of embarrassed to. But I need to, perhaps.
You perhaps need to, indeed. So, Kim, when did you start this business?
So I started teaching in November 2015, pretty much straight after I finished graduating in India in October 2015. So pretty much just got straight into it, mainly because I had people who had, you know, who knew I was training to become a teacher, and so they were keen to learn. So the moment I graduated, I was ready, I managed to find a space, and I started teaching straight away.
Fantastic. Now, why did you start this business? So you obviously learned how to meditate, but why did you want to start a business about meditation?
Yeah, that's a good question, because I'm the last person to think that I could be a meditation teacher. I'm actually a trained corporate lawyer, and I worked in corporate law for over 15 years in big companies, and really had, you know, your standard corporate law experience, working really long hours. And it was at the end of a particularly harrowing transaction that lasted more than a year that I went to see the doctor, because I was just feeling flat and tired, and the doctor did a whole barrage of tests and everything came out fine. And, you know, I was lucky I had a very progressive GP who said, well, you know, before we try medicating, you know, perhaps we should try other things, you know, maybe exercise, maybe some meditation. And that sort of led me to the whole path of meditation, and I started learning it. And it was sometime down the track, maybe about 6-8 months after I was practicing regularly, that people started noticing that I was feeling better and looking better and sounding happier and was more productive in the work that I was doing and just had better relationships with people. And they'd asked me what I was doing, and it took me a little while to put the dots together, and it was really meditation. And they started asking me, you know, where can I learn? And I'd tell them. And some of them would learn with my teacher, and then some of them would come back and say, well, what about learning with you? And I was like, no, I'm a lawyer, not a teacher. And people just kept asking me, and then one day I was speaking to my teacher, and he said, well, why don't you train to be a teacher? There's nothing in the rule book that says you can't be a corporate lawyer and a meditation teacher, if you like. So I thought about it, and I thought, well, okay, I'll give it a go. And that's pretty much how it started. So I never sort of set out to become a teacher. I set out to learn meditation, and then along the way became a teacher.
And that led you to having a business, because
it
becomes a business then as well, doesn't it?
That's right, yeah.
No, I was just going to say, so what did you want this to give you? So you kind of accidentally became a teacher, and that led you to a business. So what did you want from the business from day one? What did you think the business would do for you?
I wanted to make meditation as accessible as possible. So as lovely as meditation is, I think it still suffers from a bit of a PR problem. You know, I think saying the word meditation tends to give people these impressions that you have to go somewhere far away, removed from society, to, you know, very quiet place, hidden away, and you kind of learn meditation. You know, people wearing white robes or having become vegetarian, or, you know, there's really, you know, strong kind of spiritual religious kind of connotations with meditation. And I really felt that there was an opportunity for meditation to be much more practical, to be very modern, and to be taught in a way that made it accessible to people like me, you know, people who had, you know, corporate jobs, who had, you know, big, busy lives, and really needed something but didn't really know what it was. And it's a simple enough practice. So that was really my goal in starting to teach, was to show people that meditation, that I'm probably not the kind of person you typically think would be a meditation teacher or a practitioner, and yet I can do it, so you can too.
That's great. Thanks. So this is one of my favorite questions. When did you realize that you were actually in business? So when did the business actually become real? So, you know, and for lots of people, when they answer that question, it's a different answer for most people. So what was it that made it feel like it was a business?
Well, there were a couple of kind of pivotal moments. I think when I realized that, when I received my first sort of course fee, someone actually paid me to teach them and to talk to them about meditation. That was quite a big moment for me. And then I think that the next one was really when I went from teaching one and then to another and then to another. And there was just a continuous kind of line of students. And that sort of made me realize it wasn't a one-off thing. That it was something that was going to continue, and that this was, you know, the real thing, that that there are people here who genuinely want to learn, and I just kept teaching whoever came along, pretty much, and it's continued. So
here we are.
I guess it's real.
Oh, dearie me. So you've talked a little bit. We're going to talk about what customers want and how you know about that. And you have spoken about this, you know, that people asked you, and then, you know, as you just said, they came back and then more came. But how do you know, how did you know this was a viable business, that customers, like, what's the reinforcement that the business has efficacy and continues? I think you pretty much have answered this, but is there anything you would add?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think even though meditation has been sort of in the mainstream for a while, I think it's not really until very recently that it's become much more something that is being practiced in schools and in corporations and more in the mainstream. So it's not really seen so much now as that sort of, you know, hippy-dippy sort of practice, you know, from the 60s and 70s. Is now this has been backed by a lot more sites. Mm. And the level of interest is so different. I mean, I remember speaking to my teacher who, you know, started teaching, you know, 20 years ago, and he said when he used to say he was a meditation teacher, people would kind of go, I'm not really sure what to talk about with you now. And now when he goes into parties and he says he's a meditation teacher, he can't get away. You know, people just kind of keep asking him questions. And I've had very similar experiences where, you know, people ask me what I do and I say I teach meditation, and it sparks a whole chain of questions. I think there's very few people I've met who are not aware of meditation and who are not curious about it and what it could possibly do for them. So I think it's not a fad. I think it's really coming into its own. You know, along with the likes of yoga and all that kind of thing, I think that whole mindfulness getting a bit more into, you know, the pace of life, slowing down a bit and deepening the moment is a genuine sort of need of the time.
I think that's very insightful, Kimberly. I think that, you know, I think you're right. It has really evolved, because 20 years ago people were talking about mindfulness and meditation, but they were the outliers, weren't they? Whereas now, as you say.
Yes, yes.
And I love the way you said that, you know, and he said he was a meditation teacher. People didn't know what to talk to him about. There was that sort of uncomfortable silence. And
yes, yes.
I know, like, exactly what you're talking about. That's so
true.
Yeah,
it's like they just kind of move away.
That's
like,
right.
Back away from him. But now it's like we can't get enough. It's like, oh, what do you teach? How do you teach? Where do you teach? You know?
Yeah. And people know what he's talking about. So my next question is about money. There's a couple of questions about money. So I guess, you know, because of what you've said about meditation, there possibly isn't a lot of money needed to set this up. But in terms of the business, you know, whatever funding you needed, how did you fund the early days, and then how do you fund expansion? Like what is involved? And then I am going to ask you separately about a pricing strategy. So it's really about getting the money to get started.
Yeah, so the money to get started was entirely mine. Mm-hmm. So I basically pulled a certain amount from my savings. I mean, you are right in terms of setting up a meditation business is, you know, not as capital or expense intensive as a lot of other businesses. But I do, you know, I did have to spend a lot of time figuring out exactly where I wanted to teach in terms of the space, and then trying to, you know, obviously I hire a space with an existing business, and then, you know, trying to make sure that it all lines up in terms of the times. So I think for me, the cost of setting up the business has been more in terms of time, figuring out the location for the studio rather than the cash aspect of it. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I am looking for my own space now, and so that in itself is interesting in Sydney, as you can imagine. You know, space is very expensive. So that's my current challenge.
Yeah, and really it is about having, you know, if you're going to pay the rent for a space, how many hours out of the 24 hours are you actually going to use it, because you're paying for the entire 7 days,
yes,
24.
Yes, yeah. That's right.
Actually, Kim, there's a really interesting new group has come up. It's ALT SPC, I think is the name. It's like Airbnb, but for businesses. So encouraging people who have a business to put their business on this. I'll put it in the show notes because I just don't have it to hand at the moment. But it's matching people up with who've got a space when it's not being used, so that businesses can actually. It's not an app yet. It's actually a website-based. And they cover the insurance. It's a really interesting idea. We went to a promotion for
that's
it last
a great
week.
Idea.
Yeah, so there's loads of businesses that have got this space that's not used at various times of the day, depending on the business. And we digress. Yeah. But that's the sort of thing that maybe could be helpful to you as you look for a space to share a space with other people.
Yeah.
It's a bit like co-working, but kind of the next extension to that, you know.
Yeah, because I know, like, when I eventually get my own space, I will be open to the possibility of you know, hiring it out, you know, to a yoga teacher or something who wants to teach an hour week or something.
Yeah.
Because why should the space just kind of sit there unused? I think our ideas of space and using space has changed quite a lot in the last few years with Airbnb and things like that. So
I think people are much more willing, much more willing to share something with others rather than saying this is mine and being very proprietary about it. So then in terms of pricing strategy, so clearly you're making money from this. But just by the way, for the listeners, have you stopped working as a lawyer and you do this permanently, or are you still doing some legal work as well?
I do some ad hoc legal work, but I have stopped working full time as a corporate lawyer.
So this is your business and your income.
Yeah, this is my business. So in terms of the pricing strategy, you know, I was really guided by what my teacher was charging and what my peers charge, and we pretty much all charge roughly the same, because we do with Vedic meditation, we do come from a long line of teachers, you know, a tradition that extends back 5,000 years. So you'll find, if you ever go, you know, do some Google research on Vedic meditation teachers, we pretty much all charge roughly about the same. It's not like we have an agreement or anything like that, but we just all come out. It's because we all kind of commit a set amount of time to teaching, and so our fees are generally about the same.
So people are happy to pay it, so that's working.
Because they get, you know, a reasonable amount of instruction and time in terms of learning the meditation, and most people don't really have an issue with the cost when it comes to learning it properly.
Yep, lovely. How do you find new customers? How do you know who they are, where they are? What's your strategy? You can be as specific or as general as you like. So where are these people and how do they find you?
So everyone sets up a website these days, don't they? It's like one of the very first things everyone tells you to do. And of course, I did that as well. But to be absolutely honest with you, most of my customers don't come through the website. I mean, they may refer to the website at one point in time, but the website doesn't drive the customers through. So for me, when I finished graduating and I was trained as a teacher, the first set of customers or students that I had were obviously my friends and my family. And then it's really been through word of mouth. And with meditation and teaching, I find that that is the most powerful way to attract new students, is to have someone experience me as a teacher, experience my technique, go away and practice the meditation for a period of time, enjoy the benefits and feel the difference for themselves, and then other people around them start to notice it and they'll ask them questions, and then they'll be told, oh, well, I learned meditation. And then that's usually how I get most of my students, through word of mouth referrals. And, you know, they'll have a look at the website, but that's not what drives them to me. It's generally knowing someone who's learned with me. That I find is usually how I get most of my students.
That's lovely. That's such a nice and do you just
it's
do,
kind of it's kind of old fashioned, isn't it?
Interesting how things go around in cycles, isn't it? You know, it's amazing how many.
It is. Yeah, it is. So it's not like I said, the website is important to have, absolutely, because I think when someone refers, you know, someone to you, the first thing we all do is to go on Google and, you know, do a search and see what we can find about them. So it's useful from that point of view. It establishes credibility and gives the person a sense of what to expect. But for me, it doesn't, like, drive people through. It's that comes via my students and the people whom I've taught.
Who you've taught. Just as a, and I, this is a, an extra question around that, is do you actively seek that your students to recommend others? Do you actually ask for referrals, or do you let that happen organically?
I don't ask for referrals, but I do make it known to them that if they do refer someone to me, or you know, in some cases I've had someone who's referred like five or six students to me, I say to them, I'll give them a special rate for course fees, and that, you know, that might just help them along. But I don't necessarily ask for referrals. I think it usually happens organically. You know, it does. It's interesting.
Yeah. And especially, as you said, people notice the difference in the person and then say, what are you doing? I want some of that. I want what you've got. You know, that.
Yeah. Okay. And that's really the best advertising, yes. Isn't it, really?
Certainly is. So complete shift in gear. What's mm-hmm. your exit strategy? You don't have to tell us. Do you have an exit strategy? Is this something that goes on forever? What's your kind of begin with the end of mind, end in mind sort of strategy around this?
I don't think I have one, you know. I was contemplating this. Someone else asked me this question not that long ago. It's funny because I also don't believe in retirement, so that's maybe why I don't have an exit strategy. I don't know whether it's partly to do with my culture, but we don't really retire. So retirement is quite a foreign concept to my family and me. And so I expect to be doing something and being of service right up to the very end. Not to say that I'm going to work full time or continue to teach meditation full time, but I expect I will be teaching meditation up until the time I pass on, not full time, but certainly for a very long time. So I don't really have an exit strategy. Sorry, that's it's not a very good fine. Answer.
No, it's a perfect answer. You'd be surprised. I've done more than 40 interviews, and I think there's only two people have an exit strategy. So you're right up there.
We have an exit strategy?
Well, I guess it depends on. It depends on what it is that the business is giving you. So some mm-hmm. people actually do believe that there is a point in time in the future when they won't be doing the business and they would like to either sell it or they'll just wrap it up or, you know, that there's some end point for them. Mm-hmm. And I'm with you about the retirement thing. You know, I can't imagine not doing anything. And I think retirement is a word that belongs in another
era.
It really is. It's a redundant word, and I think we need a new word.
We do, don't we?
For whatever this is that we're all going to do for the next however long we're going to do it. We don't have that word yet. There's a few people playing around, but you're right. You know, and I think it's becoming more and more, not just cultural now, but I think there's other people saying, well, I can't imagine sitting on a porch, you know, in a rocking chair or playing golf. You know, like there's whatever this retirement picture is. So, I think that's
We're living longer too. Mm. So it's interesting when people talk about retirement because you could retire at, you know, 65, but we could all probably end up living closer to 100. I mean, that's another 40-odd years.
Yeah, and it's a long time to do nothing, you know, whatever this nothing is.
Absolutely. I think that is a challenge though, isn't it, for us, really, to try to figure out what it means.
I think the thing though too, Kim, as people get older, everything takes a little bit longer. As you get into your 70s and 80s, you know, everything just takes that little bit longer. So there isn't as much time to do as much either. So anyway, that's another conversation for another podcast, I think. Okay, so let's have some reflective questions. Regarding the business side of this meditation, what is the one thing you really wish you had done differently at the beginning?
I think sometimes I wish I had started it a bit sooner, that I had trained to become a teacher sooner, but I also realized that I don't think I was necessarily ready to teach, because I do enjoy teaching so much, and I kind of go, I wish I'd started it sooner, but I also realized that I think realistically I wasn't in a space to be teaching up until fairly recently. But that's really the only kind of regret I have, I think.
And it's a really common one.
But I wish I'd done it sooner.
It's very common among people in business. Once they get into their business, why did I wait so long to get onto this?
It's a funny thing though, isn't it? Because you're kind of, I don't know, is that the fear of it, of going on your own is quite real. And especially if you've, like me, I've only ever worked for someone, it's complete change of mindset.
I talk about, and you know, I'm not the only one talking about this concept, but it's entrepreneurial gravity. So it's that idea of, you know, gravity holds us onto the earth to stop us from flying away. And, you know, getting a business off the ground is like launching a rocket. Or, you know, if you think about those A380s heading down the runway, they run and they run and they run, and then eventually they just take off. And that's what taking, you know, so it takes such a lot of effort to get a business going.
That's true.
So that's one of the ways that I help explain that, you know, that idea that we can't start earlier because we're, you know, we're on the runway or we're warming up the engines of the rocket or, it just takes a certain amount of time.
That's a good analogy. I like that.
Thank you. So this is a different question. Is there something that you wish you'd known from the start? So if somebody had said to you, here's some information about running a business, that you could have found useful from the beginning?
I would say, and you might find this funny, but when you run a business, you're it, like you're everything. You know, I came from working in large corporate organizations where there was a department for everything. And when I started teaching, I realized I was the department of everything, which included IT, included taking the calls, included replying to all the emails, you know, setting up the room and hiring the space. So at the beginning anyway, before you can afford to get any kind of assistance, you're it. And which means you've got to be the front person, you've got to be the behind the scenes person, you've got to be the accountant, you've got to be the PR person, you've got to be, you know, the face of the business. And really, and particularly meditation, you cannot have a bad day because people are looking at me and how I react and respond to things as, you know, an example of what it's like to have a meditation practice, a regular meditation practice, you know. So, it would be that basically when you start a business, you're it. Don't expect that there's going to be someone kind of helping you out for a while anyway.
Kim, so, I have to say that is the best way I've ever heard that explained, that you're the department for everything.
You are. Like,
it's,
you know,
so true. It's so true.
When the IT does it, it's like, crap, we've got to figure this out. You know, there's no one you can ring up to go, so my computer doesn't work and I've tried this and this, you know. Mm. It's like, figure it out.
You are the department of everything. That's so cool. So a slightly different aspect. So who, apart from yourself, obviously your teacher, you've talked about your teacher quite a lot.
Yeah.
But as you've grown your meditation practice and your business for teaching meditation, who, and you can either name names or you can just talk about the person in concept, who's been of greatest assistance to you?
I would say my students have been the greatest assistance to me. Because they've been very every person that I teach, I spend a bit of time in the follow-up and also getting feedback. And they've given me the most useful feedback in terms of, you know, how I structure my teaching, what they found useful, what they found a bit difficult to understand. And it's really helped me refine the way I now present my course and the amount of time I spent on certain aspects of it and others. I've just found that, you know, my students generally have been very, very good in helping refine the way I've done things in the business. You know, and some things that I've tried that haven't quite worked out, they've kind of told me as well. So I've been quite lucky. And these aren't just necessarily people I know. I'm talking about people that I who are now friends of friends of friends kind of thing. And so they've been very good in giving feedback and really helping me refine the offering and also the way I present my business and the way the business sort of sits in terms of, you know, what it offers to them.
That's terrific. So, they are. So, and my next question was going to be around who can give you really good feedback, but it sounds like you've pretty much answered that as well, that it is your clients that give you the feedback.
Yeah, but I would say also, I mean, the general public's pretty good. Like, you know, the example that I gave earlier about, you know, when I have a conversation with people about meditation, I do take quite a lot of notes in terms of, listening to what people say and getting a real sense of what the general or mainstream view is on meditation, and then kind of refining and structuring my presentation. You know, occasionally I do go into corporates or when I meet people to do intro talks. It helps a lot. You know, there's a huge spectrum of opinions when it comes to meditation, and I know I'm in probably the minority in terms of the knowledge I have on meditation. So I find feedback from the public quite interesting.
Mm-hmm. That's terrific, because it just changes how you do everything, doesn't it?
Does. You know, it just kind of makes me realize things that sometimes that I think are important from a teacher's point of view, you know, they don't even register with the number of people that I've taught. And it's like, okay, good to know. Because we can get all a bit caught up, you know.
We can become quite myopic in our own. What we believe and that.
Absolutely.
So someone comes to you and says, I'm thinking about starting my own business. Mm-hmm. What would you tell them?
As a general rule, I tend to be, I like to be more supportive than not. Mm-hmm. I have this philosophy, and this could get us in all kinds of trouble, but my view is that do the thing that your 80-year-old self would be proud you did.
Mm, right. That's nice.
So my view is, if you genuinely have a business idea that you think has legs and you want to give it a go, then go for it. Because I think at the end of the day, you know, the worst thing that can happen is it doesn't work. And that's a better outcome to have and to know, rather than the what if, or if only I did, you know. So I would rather have lived and failed than not have tried at all. So that's my general philosophy in life. So my view is, if you really have an idea that you've kind of, you know, tested out and you've, thing has legs and you've done the research, and I think you should go for it.
And I like your caveat around that you've tested it out and it has viability, and it, you know,
yeah,
it,
I mean,
really,
I mean, we're talking, you know, like a feasible business idea.
Yes.
Not just something that just came to you overnight, you know, in a dream kind of thing, you know. It's got to be grounded in,
yeah, got to be somebody who wants to pay for
reality.
It.
Yeah. Okay. Although, what do I know? You know, Apple seems to be doing fine.
So, what three characteristics do you think you have that make you successful in your business? What is it about you?
I would say that I'm very, very persistent. Mm-hmm. So, and this was explained to me the other day by one of the researchers who does research on relationships, and he was talking about people who are good at beginnings, people who are good at middles, and people who are good at endings. Mm. And some people are good at all three things. And he said to me, you're someone who's good at all three things. Because what happens, he was, you know, in terms of a lot of businesses, he was saying, is people are good at starting. It's very exciting to start something. And then inevitably we get to the middle, and the middle is just not very sexy. You know, the middle is where you get a lot of hard work, and, you know, if you look at the way success is, it's not a straight line. It's, you know, you kind of have a peak, have a trough, you go around about, sometimes you do a U-turn, and then you go forward again, you know. And so I think I'm very persistent and I'm very patient, so I do the middle part and really well. So I think that helps a lot. And I have a larger view of life, so I take a much longer perspective of life than normal. So if I'm having a patch where business is a little bit quiet or things are not going to plan, I tend not to get too carried away. I tend to enlarge my sample of life and remember that, you know, just before this patch there were good things, and there will be good things after this patch as well. So I guess you can say I'm kind of have a glass half full perspective. So that's two things. And the third thing I think is I'm very thorough. So, mm-hmm. And I do a lot of preparation. So I'm kind of, which is why I like the analogy that you had about the plane on the runway. You know, I do a lot of work behind the scenes before I get to, you know, the door and when I greet my students, you know. So, and I think that helps a lot, particularly when it comes to teaching and teaching something like meditation.
Well,
so I think those are the attributes.
Yeah, so the persistence, the glass half full, global, the bigger picture.
Yeah.
And that the preparation. Yeah. No, that's terrific. So if you think about this person who came to you and said they wanted to start a business, would they be the attributes you would think they need, or do you think there's something else that somebody, a budding startup, would need?
I think it'd be helpful to have those attributes, but I think enthusiasm and the passion for what you're doing is important as well. Because sometimes I've had friends who've started businesses based on the fact that they think it'll be profitable, and without any genuine enthusiasm or love for what it is that they're making or selling. And I think that always shows through. I think you can always people can always spot the sincerity or lack of sincerity behind a business venture, and it's not to say that you can see it, but it's an energy, like you're feeling, you can get a sense, and that will either pull people in or people will just be indifferent, and it's because they can feel it. So and I know I'm a meditation teacher, so you know I talk about energies and all that, but it's not a hippy dippy thing. It is a genuine thing, and I think we can all tell regardless of whether we're spiritual or not, or you know.
So I think you're right, and also because now more than ever people have so much more choice. So if there is indifference, it doesn't even have to be bad. It just has to be indifference that people will go somewhere where you know the energy is better.
Well, I mean, you know, cafes or coffee in Sydney is a classic thing. Like, there's good coffee everywhere, but there'll always be coffee places that you'll go back to and others that you just won't. And it's not got to do with the coffee. I mean, the coffee's pretty much the same, I would say. You know, it's not same, but in terms of the levels of it's good generally everywhere, but you're going back not just for the coffee, you know, it's for the energy, it's for the feeling that you get when you go into that particular cafe, the conversations you have, the rapport and all that, you know.
Yeah, absolutely right. It's because we're lucky, but it's pretty much good coffee everywhere in Sydney, isn't it?
We're
spoiled.
No first world problems here.
No, absolutely. So Kim, thanks so much for your time today. And so if people in Sydney want to find you, it's kimberlychanmeditation.com.au.
Yes.
Is that right? Now, what about people who are not lucky enough to be in Sydney? Do we have a way that people who aren't in Sydney can access your brilliance?
It's possible that I can, and I have taught in Melbourne a couple of times. So it's something I am open to. If there's, you know, enough people wanting to learn, I have flown across to Melbourne, and I'm open to doing that, you know, to Brisbane or Adelaide. But it is one of those business structures where it is reliant on the individual.
Well, what is there, 5 million people in Sydney? So I reckon if you get started soon, you know, we can contact everybody, can't we?
I'm definitely open to traveling and I have done some corporates interstate as well. So that's always open. Absolutely. And the best thing to do is just to you know, either ring me or email me and we'll start a dialogue conversation, and you know, anything's possible.
Anything's possible indeed.
It's really not that bigger country. It's easily, you know, accessible.
It certainly is. So now, as we draw this conversation to a close, is there anything else that you would add? So the people listening to this podcast are predominantly people who are thinking about starting a business, or maybe in those early days. Is there anything that I haven't asked you, or that you've come across in your experience in business, that you would add before we go?
I would say this might come out sounding a bit wrong. I think it's really normal for people when they're wanting to start a business or they have an idea to kind of run it by family and friends. And I don't think that that's a bad idea. But what I do say is this: to remember that whatever opinions or responses that are given to you are given to you from the perspective of that individual. It's not an opinion based on your abilities. So it's their opinion based on how they would feel about the idea if they had to do it.
Mm.
So, you know, I think it can be a bit limiting sometimes, you know, and certainly I encountered that because, as you can imagine, there are not a lot of meditation teachers out there. I mean, I'm the first meditation teacher in my family and certainly amongst my friends. Mm. And so when I did float the idea of, becoming a meditation teacher, particularly given my corporate lawyer background, no one was supportive, funnily enough.
And that's fine,
because it was so outside the realm of their understanding that it's very hard for them to have given me any other advice.
Mm.
And I valued their advice, but I also understood that it was something completely brand new.
Yeah.
And so there was only one way for me to figure it out, and that was for me to do it. Mm. So, you know, people mean well, but they can only speak from their perspective is what I'm trying to say. So yeah. I'm not saying don't listen to what they're saying, you know, but just remember that they always speak from their point of view. And if you're trying to do something for the first time that no one in your family or your circle of friends have done, it can be hard for them to guide you. That you shouldn't be discouraged.
That's it. And as you said, if it all lines up, give it a go. So, yeah, that's terrific. Kimberly, thanks so much for your time.
It's been
a terrific conversation. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thanks, Ingrid.
So what are you taking away from Kimberly's wisdom? You know, I've listened back a couple of times to this interview, and there is so much valuable wisdom in this interview. You may want to go back and have another listen, or you may want to head over to my blog where there is a full transcript of our conversation. www.healthynumbers.com.au. Head to the blog and all the transcripts for the podcasts are there. And you know what? Hasn't Kimberly got the most perfect voice for teaching meditation? I'm going to admit that I've taken Kimberly's course and I am meditating every day. It's a bit of a challenge because it's something new, but it is truly making a difference for me. And if you're keen to learn, I can highly recommend it, and I can absolutely recommend Kimberly. You know, one of the things is we meditate at a retreat or, you know, when we're off in the middle of the bush or when we're at the beach, but Kimberly's taught me how to meditate in the everyday, and I am really grateful. So thanks for listening, and if you are thinking about getting started in your own business, I have written a book called So You Want to Start a Business, and you can grab a generous excerpt over at www.soyouwanttostartabusiness.com.au, and we'll send you, you'll just be asked for your email and your name, and we'll send you an excerpt. As always, you can find full transcripts, as I said, over on the website. And you know what? Ideas without action, well, they're just that. They're just ideas. So what action are you inspired to take today? Thanks for listening.